Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What price is paid by the estimated 500,000 women and girls who labor in American agriculture? A significant number of them earn poverty-level wages to nurture and harvest the crops and livestock that find their way to our tables every day. And along with the backbreaking work, they face a little-known but very real risk of sexual harassment and assault on the job. As my guest today has discovered, many fear not only the attacks on their bodies and their human dignity, but also the consequences of speaking out. Lowell Bergman is Distinguished Professor of Investigative Reporting at the University of California, Berkeley, and a producer and correspondent for the PBS series Frontline. His new documentary, Rape in the Fields, airs tonight on Frontline at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. Lowell, welcome to Think.
Nice to be here.
This story is so disheartening, in part because it seems there is just no end to the plight of farm workers in America. Can you talk about how this issue came to your attention and why it has been underreported in the past?
Well, it came through a graduate student who was on an internship back east and was sent into the fields of North Carolina to look for child labor and came back with a story about a woman who, she said, told her that she had borne 8 children to keep her job, 8 children with her labor contractor. And she pursued that for a while, did a paper on it, and left. And we kept nurturing the story, and last year made a deal with Univision as well as Frontline and the Center for Investigative Reporting, which is in our area out here, to pursue the story in depth. And what you'll see tonight is a result of that. By the way, there's a companion Spanish language version on Univision at 7 o'clock on Saturday, and they've been running pieces all week on the subject.
And of course, a major problem is that many of these women feel that they can't report their crimes, a point that was outlined beautifully by farm worker advocate Dolores Huerta in the documentary. We'll listen to that now.
Harassment is part of the job, so to speak. Women are looked at as sex objects when they're out there in the field. Sexual harassment is an epidemic in the fields, and it again goes back to the vulnerability that women have, the farm worker women have. They work in isolated places. Many of them don't speak English. A lot of them don't even know the laws. They don't even know that they can report sexual harassment and that the employer can be responsible for that. And so they feel helpless.
That's Dolores Huerta in Lowell Bergman's Frontline documentary, Rape in the Fields, which airs tonight on KERA Channel 13 television. To what extent, Lowell, is the fact that these women are undocumented at the heart of this problem?
Well, first is a general power imbalance, which is what Ms. Huerta is talking about. The undocumented question, and here we don't know, we don't have precise numbers, but the Department of Labor agrees that a majority of the over 600,000 women working in the fields are undocumented. Some of the employer organizations we talked to said 80% are what they call document challenged. They can't, for instance, say that they're undocumented because then it would be illegal for them to employ them. But if we, the problem of being undocumented is very clear. You're afraid of the federal government. They're the people who might deport you. So how can you trust them? So, or you're afraid of law enforcement because law enforcement, you see them operating in raids on various sites and deporting people and assisting immigration authorities. So that's pointed out, I think, dramatically by the sheriff of Wright County, Iowa, who we interviewed about what happened in his location, in his area, and his own experience with this.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That's a really heartbreaking story. There was it's a poultry plant, right, that was essentially when the feds would come and do raids looking for undocumented workers, the plant would basically just hide their workers away and say, you can't leave.
Well, this particular operation in Iowa, by the way, when you say poultry plant, I mean, I was amazed at the size of these plants. I mean, they're as big as your cowboy stadium in the middle of a cornfield. And they, or they stretch for long distances if they're in not multi-storied. The bottom line is that this industrial form of agriculture created a situation where the company, in this case, the DeCoster company, partnered with another company to import workers from Mexico and further south, sent their supervisors south to import the women into and get them into the plants, and then would hide them. Obviously, they were valuable to them. They didn't want them deported. So they would lock them in the plants when immigration patrols were around.
So, again, there's this sense that, you know, women aren't quite sure who to trust. They don't want to lose their jobs. They don't want to leave the country. And so if things that they're uncomfortable with are taking place, if they're being abused, they have to make this calculation.
That's right. And by the way, the abuse is from, generally speaking, could be coworkers, but most of the cases we've seen involve supervisors or people who have authority over them. In one, another case in Iowa, it involved managers in the plant. And they have good reason not only to be skeptical about whether there are going to be consequences for any of these people, because they may get deported, but even where they do manage to file charges or tell their stories or even get a what's known as a U visa, which allows them as a victim of crime to assist law enforcement, no one that we could see was ever criminally prosecuted as a result of any of these complaints nationwide.
So the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has made this problem a priority, but of course they're filing civil lawsuits and not criminal lawsuits.
And furthermore, yesterday the Supreme Court just weakened their authority, in particular these kinds of cases.
Can you elaborate on that? I haven't seen the story.
What the Supreme Court decided was that the EEOC now had a higher burden to prove that someone, that the company should be responsible for the actions of a supervisor. And the definition of what a supervisor is just went up a couple of notches from someone who had authority over people to someone who has to be able to have the authority to hire and fire and do all kinds of other things. In fact, in some of these cases, particularly one of the main cases we pointed out that's a precedent case 10 years ago, the supervisor in question had none of those authorities. He was simply in charge of moving various things around, trailers and other things, and was at a higher level than just a regular worker. So he probably would never have lost that civil case, or Harris Farms in California would never have lost that case given the current Supreme Court ruling.
Well, it's interesting in light of the comments that you included from former Labor Secretary Robert Reich with regard to allegations against a plant and this question as to whether it is fair to sort of hold companies accountable for what individual employees might do.
In my experience, when you have companies that disregard one set of laws, they're likely to be disregarding all laws. They're likely to create a culture that is not just one of illegality, but one of crass disregard for the lives of employees.
That was former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. My guest is Lowell Bergman, who's produced a documentary for Frontline called Rape in the Fields, which airs tonight on KERA Channel 13 television. Did you get the sense that you agreed with former Secretary Reich?
Well, let me just point out that when we were looking at DeCoster, and we just, because we had heard about the case there, and we'd heard about this woman, Sonia Paras, who's an immigration lawyer in Des Moines, we saw his name in the clips back in the 1990s related to DeCoster. So he had personal experience attempting to enforce labor laws, just basic labor laws related to DeCoster. He did not get involved initially in any of the allegations of sexual violence that came after the Clinton administration. So do I agree? I agree with him that in this particular case and in others that I've looked at in other industries, you do find companies that have serial violations of regulations, whether it's OSHA regulations, EPA regulations, and the list goes on. DeCoster, for example, most recently gave up egg processing, except they still now they lease out their facilities because they got charged with the largest contamination in the history of the United States of salmonella poisoning of at least 1,500 people. Hmm. So they've obviously had problems with everything from health violations to immigration violations.
And the folks at DeCoster would not speak to you?
No, they wouldn't. We talked with their attorney. We tried to track them down at their homes. We knocked on doors, and you'll see some of that in the film.
So you did find a few women, certainly, who have spoken out and who were willing to share their stories with you for the Frontline piece. What did they tell you motivated them to break their silence?
Well, in most cases, as in the case of Maricruz Landino, who was featured in the story, it was because they felt that somebody had to say something, and that that they were able to survive at least by coming public or bringing charges, that is civil charges in almost all the cases, and encouraging other people to speak out. That was their motivation. It took many, many months for us to both meet and then talk with people, primarily off camera, until just a few months ago when we were doing this for about a year before people started to actually appear on camera. It's a long process of getting people's trust, but also of them feeling maybe this could make a difference. And a big factor in this, by the way, is that this is the first time that PBS has ever, A, partnered with a outside broadcast network in a news presentation, particularly a documentary, definitely the first time for Frontline. And significantly, one of the reasons many people cooperated was because it would be a version of this on Univision. And they have 85% penetration of the Hispanic market in the United States. And Univision itself, since Sunday, has been running some of their own shorter pieces almost every day and promoting their broadcast, which will be 7 o'clock on Saturday. So we'll see what kind of impact this has.
I wonder, Lowell, if this these revelations are somehow less surprising within the Spanish-speaking community of the United States?
The Spanish-speaking, well, listen, one of the leads we had on this is the Spanish-speaking population of people that I knew personally when I who have experience in agriculture. When I went around talking with them, they all said, of course, that's surprising. When I started picking in the fields when I first came here, that was the price of getting a job. So this is at least anecdotally well known in the community. It's not talked about a lot. There's a lot of cultural reasons, and you can understand personal reasons why women wouldn't want to share this with their families. This is the reason why I have to do this in order to put food on the table. I have to do this to keep my job. I have to do this. I mean, in the Postville case in Iowa, Representative Gutierrez, he went there, and he recounts, actually this is in the Spanish language version, women recounting stories to him of if they wanted to get a day off, they had to arrange sex. If they wanted to get overtime, they had to arrange sex. If they wanted to go to the doctor, they had to arrange sex. So there was a price to be paid in some of these locations. We're not saying that we have evidence that this is going on throughout the industry, but it's definitely prevalent. It's definitely there, and the protections for the people involved are minimal.
And it's so heartbreaking to hear these accounts from women who essentially tell you that they basically just help each other out by trying to warn new coworkers about who to watch out for, even though ultimately they're probably powerless to do much about advances that they don't want.
They are. I mean, They don't realize, as Dolores Huerta points out, that the employer can be held responsible. They don't realize that there may be some protections if they can get a U visa. They don't. The workers themselves are not aware. And in three states in the United States, employers by law have to conduct sexual harassment training, particularly of supervisors and foremen. That's in three states: California, Connecticut, in Maine, not Texas.
Lowell Bergman is my guest. He's professor of investigative reporting at UC Berkeley and producer for the PBS series Frontline. His documentary Rape in the Fields airs tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. We'll come back to the conversation in just a couple of minutes. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
I remember one of them saying, "I'm just tired of having sex at work." So I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, I want to keep my job, but I don't want to have sex at work anymore. And that was when I realized the magnitude of the situation. The women are being raped and are being sexually assaulted. And they know that immigration is outside. They're also seeing law enforcement working with them. So if you're seeing law enforcement coming into your plant and taking your coworkers, you're not going to go to them the next day to say, by the way, can you help me?
That is immigration attorney Sonia Parras, who appears in Lowell Bergman's new Frontline documentary, Rape in the Fields, that airs tonight on KERA Channel 13 television at 9 o'clock. We have Lowell Bergman with us for this hour's discussion, and we invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Lowell, before the break, you spoke once again about this thing called the U visa, which, as I understand it, allows victims in criminal trials to sort of stay in the country despite their immigration status for the duration of their trial so that they can testify. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was approximately 3 years that they're allowed to stay in the country. And it gives them, in a sense, the security. If they're certified, first of all, there's a process to it. So a law enforcement agency has to certify that, let's say, you come forward or want to come forward, that you are assisting law enforcement and that you may be a witness to a victim of serious crime and, in particular, some form of abuse, rape, kidnapping, assault, et cetera. And this was a part of what was called the Violence Against Women's Act, an amendment to it that took place about 14 years ago. The first certifications to take place took place in Iowa at that DeCoster plant by that sheriff.
So he obtained those certifications, but ultimately the district attorney in the case dropped the sexual assault charges.
They never filed charges.
Okay,
the
never
district
filed
attorney just concluded that he didn't think he could make the case beyond a reasonable doubt. Unfortunately, we couldn't interview him because shortly after he did that, apparently he passed away from a heart attack. But in many cases, as we asked the sheriff, we know that he could have taken it to the state attorney general. He tried. He said that didn't work. He had brought the FBI in to witness the statements by the women. They said there was nothing they could do. We later contacted the FBI, and they just simply say this is not part of their jurisdiction. ICE, the immigration authorities, they didn't have a reaction. And again, when we contacted them on this issue as a whole, they say they don't ask the people that they seize in a raid, let's say at a factory, what was going on in terms of the any violence against the women or any other criminal activity that might have been going on inside the plant. And the same happened with the Department of Labor and the Department of Agriculture when we made inquiries.
So ultimately, the focus in those raids is really on the criminality, alleged criminality of the undocumented worker and of the fact that he or she was employed, rather than anything else that might have taken place.
That they were present illegally in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There are indications of ICE, in particular, certifying U visas in a couple of cases in Arizona that involve what is described by the federal government as human trafficking. And there we do see activity on the part of the federal government, the FBI, and other agencies. But they don't include, interestingly enough, a situation where people are in a factory or in a agricultural labor situation where they're in debt, for instance, to a coyote or in debt to the company itself, have no other means of support, are here, can't do anything, can't support their children, for instance, if they were to lose their job, and are helpless otherwise. That apparently is not defined as being incarcerated or in any way having your freedom taken away.
Of course, it's horrifying enough to know that there are numerous women who are victims of these kinds of crimes, but of course there are teenage girls working in the fields as well.
There are, and even that didn't seem to get the attention of authorities in Iowa when it was documented after the large post-fill raid, which you may remember, the largest single-site removal in the history of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It took place about 5 years ago.
You tell a really sad story here of a woman who brought her daughter to work with her. Can you tell us about that?
Well, her name is Angela Mendoza, and she lives in a what I would call a rural slum called Sunnyside, outside of Yakima, Washington, populated primarily by people of Hispanic descent who work in the fields, primarily apple orchards. And she has said that, and said to us on camera, and has testified in deposition that when she brought her then 15-year-old daughter to work, that the foreman for this section of Evans Fruit, Evans Fruit's an operation, 17,000 acres, this guy ran a section of that called Rattlesnake Ranch for many years, and that he began to harass her daughter. And later, she says she discovered him groping her daughter. Based on that and her confrontation with him, she and her daughter quit, and she filed charges against Evans Fruit and named the foreman, Juan Marin, as the perpetrator in 2006. Unfortunately, 2 years later, her daughter was murdered in a shotgun blast, unrelated apparently to anything doing directly with the litigation or what was going on at Evans Fruit. But it attracted a lot of attention locally, and in the end, 26 women signed on to the complaint. Unfortunately, the death of her daughter meant the end of her claim and also an end of her case. So she never testified.
Yeah, and she laments to you, and it really just, I mean, it's hard not to feel for her. She says the fact that her daughter was dropped from this claim makes it seem almost as if that suffering never happened, that it didn't count for anything.
That's her position, and I think more somewhat infuriating for her, I know, is that when we told her what Juan Marin said, when we interviewed him, he said that this was all a verbal misunderstanding. She didn't understand what he was saying to her daughter. And that seemed to upset her quite a bit.
And you were able to find Juan Marin. He is still walking around. He's still working. You went out and shot videotape of him working somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, he worked for Evans Fruit, I believe, until 2010, 2011. He had been there for 30 years. They say they didn't fire him. The original suit itself was filed in 2010. They had warned him that if he was charged further by other people in a letter that he would be fired. But then they fired him after the lawsuit was filed. But they said they fired him for embezzlement. So he's upset about that, and he says, quote, it's all lies. And by the way, he was not hard for us to find, and he was still in the area, and he was happy to tell his story. He wanted to tell his story.
He seems to not feel that he's done anything wrong. And again, we want to stress that he has not been criminally convicted. These are allegations against him. But there
and,
are,
and he hasn't even been held responsible in the civil case.
Yeah, but those are a lot of allegations.
They were, and we did find other documents on file in the court and in the police at the police department. He had been accused of doing this many years before. The police dismissed it as a he said, she said. This was not a new allegation. We had people coming forward, and this was the interesting part of it to us. Even after the case went to trial, after the court, the jury held that their Evans Fruit wasn't liable, more women came forward to talk to us, some of whom you see in shadow, saying that this has been going on. And we met any number of, we've lost count of the number of women who had similar allegations.
So, Lowell, is the position of Evans Fruit, hey, as soon as we figured out there was really a problem, we let this guy go? But because, they, as you said, he was fired for embezzlement and not for sexual harassment or assault.
Right. Now, you know, we've had discussions with their attorneys about why embezzlement and not sexual harassment, and they say there's no proof of the sexual harassment, but they can prove the embezzlement. But then we asked them, why didn't you file charges against him then for embezzlement? And they said, oh, the family, that is the Evans family that owns the operation and manages, by the way, was tired of going to court. It's a situation where on camera you'll see the attorney saying that Juan Marin's credibility is in question. So they, in a sense, throw him under the bus and say, we didn't see what was going on.
All right, so let's talk about what I found to be really the single most disturbing element of a very powerful hour of television, and that was when you caught up with another man who was accused of rape, Rene Rodriguez.
Well, there, you know, you're as a reporter, you're wondering, after you hear these stories, as I think your questions show, you know, what happened to these people? If they've been, if you identify a perpetrator, and there's no criminal charges against them, where do they go?
Mm-hmm.
In Rene Rodriguez's case, he testified. His company lost the case. The jury did not believe him. But the company gave him a retirement party. He left and he moved to South Texas, and that's where we found him. And it was simply a matter of walking up on him, and you see his reactions on camera.
Yeah, now, these exchanges take place in Spanish, so we're not going to play them here, but in a way, I wish we could guarantee that our whole audience could understand what happens. Can you describe what you, and I think this will be so powerful in the Univision piece, the questions that you asked and then his responses?
Well, the questions really were, what's your reaction to having been held responsible for raping a woman three times? And then finally, you know, he denies it all, as you would expect, and then asks the question, well, what about the allegations? And in fact, when he says, well, I didn't do anything wrong, or he says, I did do something wrong. I had an affair with her.
Mm-hmm.
So he says it's all consensual. That was his defense at the time. But then when asked the question, did you rape her? He doesn't have an answer for quite a while. And then when asked the question further, the allegations are you used a knife and a gun, he smiled and said, well, if I had done that, I would be in jail or prosecuted.
Hmm.
And in fact, he wasn't. And the Fresno County Sheriff, who has the most immediate jurisdiction, initially had time finding any record of the case. When we explained the case to them, said that they didn't know why they didn't follow up on it since there was a civil judgment.
I'm curious about your response the first time you saw this exchange.
Well, I mean, from a reporter's point of view, you don't expect to get that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's just that simple. You're stunned. And there's a lesson in the business that it takes a while to learn. When you ask a question, don't necessarily expect the person to answer right away. In fact, not answering often is more revealing than the answer itself.
So what kinds of organized efforts exist to help women protect themselves and on the part of companies that ostensibly would want to protect their employees?
Well, they would have sexual harassment policies in place. They would make sure that everyone had been educated as to how they can exercise those policies, that those policies in the states that mandate them, there are standards. You know, there are issues of confidentiality. There are issues of that involve trying to get to the bottom of the allegations and not punishing someone for coming forward. At the same time, you obviously have to be careful about people who, for other reasons, may make allegations that turn out not to be true. So there is established procedures for all of this. And at the same time, it appears that in states like California, which has had the most, if you will, advanced labor management struggles over the last number of decades, you do have somewhat of an infrastructure in place in the communities themselves. So there sometimes are places to go. In California, there's California Rural Legal Assistance, which has in some ways instigated a lot of this activity in the state. In fact, they're the ones, in large part, who educated the EEOC to this problem 15 years ago or more, almost 20 years ago. So what I would say is that you have, and then you have companies that, as I said, have these policies in place and want to make sure they're running a good workplace. There will be a piece on the Frontline website about Florida that we couldn't include in the program itself. And so if you're looking for an example of how workers banded together in Southwest Florida, and one of the main issues was sexual harassment and assault, and how local growers decided to, in fact, change their ways. And part of the way that happened was is that the workers' organization went to the buyers, in this case, Trader Joe's, McDonald's, Burger King, and this group called the Immokalee Workers got agreements with them that if they put codes of conduct in place and they set up a monitoring organization, that then they could guarantee that the tomatoes they were buying were done with, if you will, the human rights of the workers taken into consideration. So there are things like that going on as well, but not in that many places.
I wonder if part of the problem could be that, you know, if you are working in an industry where you are heavily dependent on, as the euphemism goes, document-challenged employees, you're also not digging too deep into the backgrounds of your foremen.
Well, document-challenged, it's interesting you bring up that term. I was introduced to that in talking to representatives of agribusiness in California. When you say illegal alien or undocumented worker, they correct you and say, we call them document challenged. And why do they say that? Because it would be illegal for them to knowingly hire someone to work and they produce and have no papers. So what happens is people come in with papers that look okay, look like Social Security card, but in fact are not real cards. And so they call their workers document challenged.
Lowell Bergman is my guest. He's professor of investigative reporting at UC Berkeley and producer for the PBS Frontline series. His documentary, Rape in the Fields, will air tonight on Frontline on KERA Channel 13 television. That starts at 9 o'clock. You can join this conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lowell Bergman. He is Distinguished Professor of Investigative Reporting at UC Berkeley and a producer for the PBS series Frontline. His documentary, Rape in the Fields, debuts tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television in North Texas and on PBS stations around the country. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Are there limitations, Lowell, on the protections that the EEOC can extend to workers who technically don't have permission to be employed in this country?
There isn't much they can do other than they can get a protective order where the other side cannot bring out their immigration status as an issue. But other than the U visa, there is no way they can protect them from possible deportation.
And what about the agriculture industry itself? You know, there have been successful boycotts in the past as workers organized around other labor abuses. But ultimately, I mean, people need to eat, and so it's very hard to sort of boycott an entire industry until changes are made.
Listen, there's almost, as we said, no attention given to this and a number of other major issues. And by the way, the question of sexual violence at work appears to be not only, if you will, a hidden story in agriculture, but as I learned doing this story, wherever you see poor immigrant workers, and particularly undocumented workers, you see this kind of problem. And the biggest area appears to be in the service industry. For example, the people who probably clean your building at night. And some of the larger cases that the EEOC has made particularly some in the Los Angeles area, revolve around that issue. And so I think all of us might want to reflect for a bit on what actually goes on in the workplace where the people are poor, may not speak the language, possibly are undocumented, and have no recourse.
Yeah, it adds an entire dimension of fear to the lives of people who already sort of worry about just making a living.
Right. Deportation isn't exactly something they want to see happen. They came here to make a living.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's part of the problem as well, that somehow there are so many people who feel as if these individuals don't deserve to be here, that somehow they are damaging to the economy, and therefore people are willing to turn a blind eye to these abuses?
You know, I'm in Berkeley, California, where things like organic vegetables and fruits are highly prized.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the people who worry about that, or worry about how their chickens are treated, and animals in general, rarely think about the workers who actually have to work doing the hard part of the job.
Yeah, and it's very often, aside from any risk of assault, it's physically taxing, dangerous work that sort of breaks a human body down after a matter of years.
Well, that's why the agricultural sector itself is one of the most dangerous workplaces in the country. It's widely known. They're not covered necessarily by all the same regulations. It can vary from state to state. And yes, it's a place where you generally speaking can expect to be injured before any other workplace you might be in.
Is there any particular reason that that individuals who would be inclined to commit these crimes end up in these foreman positions?
We didn't do any research on it. What we are looking at, I think, is an area where there's been very little in the way of study of any kind. When I did talk with the representatives of agribusiness and various companies, and they would say, well, we don't believe in this study. For instance, Human Rights Watch did a report which really had a minimum number of people that they interviewed. I think it was less than 100. And so the industry questions that. But when I asked the question in turn, well, why don't you guys do a survey? Can't you do some kind of survey to determine what's exactly going on, bring in an outside party, if you don't believe this is really a problem? And I never got a response to that.
We have an email here that says, do you think that the perpetrators of these offenses, as well as law enforcement's oblivion to the matter, is related to the fact that they think these women are breaking the law in the first place? How does the fact that Americans are ignorant about immigration law affect the issue?
Well, I think if you're in the place of law enforcement, as a sheriff from Wright County said, you're caught in the middle here.
Mm-hmm.
You may have victims, but you know that the people don't trust you. You know that they're not necessarily going to be great witnesses. And you know, particularly if we get into the area of sexual assault or rape, where it's very difficult to make a case, they're also going to be reluctant. You know, in 70% of the rape convictions involve DNA. You're not going to find that in many of these cases. In fact, people don't report it for months, sometimes years afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very difficult area to operate in, given particularly the criminalization of the victims under our immigration laws.
Well, even the geographic isolation of certain agricultural facilities must contribute to that.
Right, well, and isolation in general. So
mm-hmm.
It could be in a plant late at night, could be out in the fields during the day, and that's what you'll see when you see the film.
We want to remind you all that this documentary that we're talking about is a partnership between Frontline, Univision, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley, of course. And there will be an airing tonight of the Frontline program on KERA Channel 13 at 9 o'clock. And there is also a program airing on Univision stations around the country on June 29th. Just wanted to remind you. Is there anything, Lowell, that we as consumers can do? When I go to buy apples, I can find out what country it was produced in, but I can't find out what state or what farm cooperative.
I don't know. You know, I don't know that beyond people being conscious of some of the factors here and keeping an eye on the issue and understanding that there are these hidden costs that go on in much of our society, I'm not sure what you can do about it at this point, given a Supreme Court that just removed one of the let's say some of the ability of the only agency involved to police the situation. I'm not sure what we can do in this situation other than continue to report on it.
So individual advocates for these women, including a number of people that you profile in the documentary, are simply now just continuing to take all this a case at a time.
That's the way it is, and as Willie Smith, an attorney in Fresno, California, says, you know, they're just really, as he explained, there isn't very much money in this as a private practitioner.
Right.
And remember that when someone does bring a lawsuit in this area, the damages are based upon their lost income in large part. And so if you're only making $13,000 a year, there isn't going to be a lot of money recovered.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose for big companies, sometimes it's easier to simply pay a fine without admitting to criminal guilt than to fix a problem.
Well, a number of companies, you know, you have to say a number of companies have settled these charges and have instituted all kinds of reforms. Tanimura and Antle is the largest lettuce grower in the world, primarily does that in California and Arizona. And they were hit with one of the first EEOC charges, and they settled it, and they have been proudly saying that they have changed their ways, that they have sexual harassment policies in place, and there haven't been any further complaints as far as I know. So there are places that do change.
It does seem as if it would be a relatively simple thing to bring on every new farm worker and say, here's what you can expect and here are your rights. Like if they were somehow, if employers were required to provide a list of rights in a worker's native language, maybe some
Well, they are required to post the EEOC regulations at the place of work. Doesn't mean that they require everyone to read them or to study them.
Mm-hmm.
There are three states, as I think I said, that California, Connecticut, and Maine, that require that the foreman and supervisors actually be trained. And there is training going on, particularly in California, you know, by a lot of it provided by a kind of industry co-op called AgSafe that gets into both issues of safety in general and sexual harassment and other discrimination issues. There's a motivation if the companies in question are worried about the cost of litigation. And that's what's happened up in Washington State, for example, where, according to industry representatives, just the fact that the EEOC brought this Evans case, but also they brought another case that involves an actual rape, and they're investigating more cases. So the industry is beginning on its own, just from a cost point of view, to institute some forms of sexual harassment training.
Did you find out anything about the presumed history of this issue to the extent that was it less of a problem when a greater percentage of farm workers might have been U.S. citizens?
Well, we don't know. No one studied it in the past.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know, and which a number of people have brought up in the course of various interviews, is that we now know, for instance, in the plantation history of agriculture in the United States, the sexual exploitation of women was routine.
Yeah.
How that had progressed over the last 150 years, the history of all of that, is yet to be written.
You know, when you put it in that context, it really is chilling because we feel like we're so far beyond that, and yet it seems we're not.
Well, as Ms. Sonia Parras said, who is a native, by the way, of Spain, she was dumbstruck when she saw the working conditions of people in Iowa. In the fields. She didn't think that was possible in the United States.
And there are, as you mentioned, an estimated 600,000 undocumented women working in the fields. Did you have any evidence that men are abused in similar ways?
There have been allegations filed of men being assaulted by female supervisors. And there have been allegations that male supervisors have assaulted other men.
Mm-hmm.
And harass them. So that is on the books, but we had no way to gauge how prevalent that is.
How aware do you think lawmakers are of this issue?
Other than specific people like Congressman Gutierrez, who's part of the Hispanic caucus, who you'll see in the film, and people like Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, it appears to be a growing awareness in Congress, but by no means a top priority.
Will you talk just a little bit as we finish out the hour about the partnership with Univision and how that came about and why it was particularly helpful in producing a program like this one?
Well, a couple of years ago, I became aware that Univision had a new head of news, a man named Isaac Lee, who was a very, very well-known magazine editor out of Columbia and who's based now in Miami. And they'd made him head of their news division, and they were beginning to expand into actually creating more news, doing documentaries, doing things that Univision has never done before. In fact, they just recently created a partnership with ABC News to create a cable news channel. So I approached them a year or so ago about the idea of not just collaborating, we had discussed that before, but of doing this specific project. And that Frontline got on board, and in turn we recruited the Center for Investigative Reporting and my little operation here at Berkeley, and that's the way we went forward. The idea, for instance, this will be the first time in anybody's memory, that there's cooperation between two over-the-air broadcasting organizations on a documentary that's going to be aired during the same approximate time period.
And I guess the brilliance is that you're not necessarily competing for the same audience. You can just simply both serve a broader audience.
The idea is that it will help get the story out to the people who need to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, by the way, given these days of, as you know, at public television or public radio, of tight
times, budgets, right.
It allows us to do the kinds of investigations and reporting that a story requires. This took a year.
How similar are the two finished products other than being in two different languages?
In the PBS version is 52 minutes long. The Univision version is 46 minutes long because they have commercial breaks.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they're pretty much track each other. There's some things in the Univision version I wish we had in the English version, and I think they think vice versa. But what the other thing is that they were able to do and have been able to do beginning this past Sunday is they have other venues to do companion stories.
Hmm.
So they've already done a story, for instance, about the situation in Florida as a separate piece with Primer Impacto, one of their programs, that we couldn't fit into our broadcast. And they did another piece of which they expanded on some of the basic issues last Sunday. So it's been, for me, a really valuable collaboration, and I'm sure the aftermath of it will be even more important.
Lowell Bergman is professor of investigative reporting at UC Berkeley and producer for PBS Frontline. The documentary Rape in the Fields airs tonight on KERA Channel 13 television at 9 and on PBS stations across the country. The program is a partnership between Frontline, Univision, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley. If you want to see the show in Spanish, it airs on Univision June 29th. Lowell, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy with production assistance from Lindsay Connect. Podcast is done by Christine McConnell. Jeff Whittington is executive producer, and I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.